Welcome to Power Play. Happy New Year to everyone. I hope you're all safe. I'm Evan Solomon. We got a great show today coming up. New school delays and restrictions. Ready or not?
We are planning for worst case scenarios up to and including illness rates of as high as 50 to 60%.
School openings delayed, restrictions on businesses, canceling medical services. Was Canada ready for the Omicron surge? Who's accountable for the chaos and the last-minute decisions? We'll ask the Ontario government and get some perspective from Dr. Isaac Bogosh. And then, a $40 billion settlement agreement. But why no timeline for compensation?
More than 200,000 children and families are impacted by this compensation agreement.
As a next step, and a difficult one, Canada and the parties will negotiate a final settlement agreement, which will map out how compensation will flow to First Nations children and families. It will establish a framework for long-term funding to improve services for children and families.
With hundreds of thousands of children and families waiting for court-ordered compensation, why is there still no compensation on this historic agreement in principle? How will the government reform the system that discriminated against Indigenous children? In moments, we'll ask the Indigenous Services Minister, Patty Hajdu, and also Cindy Blackstock. She's the one who led the fight for compensation. Will give us her perspective. We've also got a live event from Alberta we're standing by for. Premier Jason Kenney, this is Power Play. Let's get to the players.
Canada could have settled this case for hundreds of millions of dollars back in 2000 when we raised the alarm that First Nations kids were getting 70 cents on the dollar compared to other kids and families were being separated unnecessarily. But Canada chose not to do that. And now we're into the tens of billions of dollars. And most importantly, children have lost their lives and sometimes their childhoods in the process.
Welcome to a new year, everyone. But as you can see, a new year with old challenges. Of course, first, the pandemic is raging again, and as I said, we'll be digging into that response. Too restrictive, not restrictive enough, all these measures. And what about the federal and the provincial government? Are they doing their jobs? We'll get to that in a minute. And those questions are defining the first days of the new year. But as you just saw today, the federal government's also trying to use the new year to resolve another old problem. Compensation for First Nations children impacted by the child welfare system. Today, the government announced some details of their new $40 billion settlement agreement in principle. $20 billion is set aside for compensation to on-reserve children removed from their homes between April 1991 and March 2022. The other $20 billion is set aside to overhaul the First Nations child and family services. That's to be spent over 5 years. Now, for context, all of this stems from a 2007 complaint to the Human Rights Tribunal from the First Nations Children and Family Caring Society and the Assembly of First Nations. They allege that the underfunding of child welfare services for on-reserve children amounted to discrimination. The Human Rights Tribunal agreed in 2016, but the federal government kept appealing and fighting it. The question now remains, with this new agreement in principle, it's non-binding, by the way, when will people actually get compensated? Will some people have to keep fighting to get their particular compensation? Let's find out. Joining me now is Indigenous Services Minister Patty Hajdu. Happy New Year, if we can say that, given the circumstances, Minister, but good to see you and hope you and your clans are well. Let's get right to this, if you don't mind. Why is there, you know, the $40 billion settlement, $20 billion and $20 billion, I understand that. We talked about this in the end of last year. What's missing here is there's no timeline in place to compensate First Nations children and families. This is a non-binding agreement. When will people actually see the details and know when they're going to be compensated?
Well, first of all, I have to thank all the parties that worked so incredibly hard over the last 6 weeks to get to this historic deal. It's a signed agreement in principle. All parties have signed on. And you're right. It splits the work into two buckets, if you will. One on compensation for harms for Indigenous children, First Nations children that were removed from their homes or experienced discriminatory services. But the second bucket on reforming the system and putting putting enough money into the system for that long-term reform to make sure this doesn't happen continuously to children in the future. So on the compensation, this will be work ahead for First Nations leaders and communities to determine the best, safest, and most equitable way to compensate people. Of course, we'll be there as a partner to make sure that that work has the support it needs, and we'll be there to mobilize the resources as they're required.
Like again, Cindy Blackstock's reaction, and she's going to join us on this program in a minute. Her big question is when. Like, this has got to happen. So why is there no timeline as to say when will people know what the timeline on compensation will be?
Well, I will thank Dr. Blackstock and indeed all of the other parties who insisted that the compensation regime be done in a thoughtful way through First Nations leadership. Those conversations will continue over the next months now to make sure that a process is put into place that is fair, as I said, that does acknowledge the kinds of harms that people experience, and most importantly, I think, doesn't re-traumatize individuals. We saw in previous compensation regimes, whether it was for residential school survivors or other kinds of situations, where people were actually traumatized by the process of having to apply for that compensation. And I think we've learned a lot as a country, but certainly I think one of the most important things we've learned is that these kinds of regimes need to be designed by First Nations people to make sure that they're done in a culturally appropriate and culturally safe way.
Now, she's saying it's the government's job to, quote, land the plane. So
I think it's all of our jobs to land the plane. And I think Dr. Blackstock, as a signatory to the agreement in principle, has put in a number of, important contributions to the agreement, as have, for example, Deputy Grand Chief Narcisse from Anishinaabe Aski Nation, who talked about the need for remoteness quotient considerations. And, of course, Regional Chief Cindy Woodhouse and of course, the representatives from Chiefs of Ontario in the class action litigants. This has been an ongoing and I would say very robust conversation facilitated by the Honourable Murray Sinclair, as you know, who has been incredibly helpful in making sure that we stay focused on what matters, which is obviously the wellness of First Nations children.
Okay, the other second bucket, as you call it, the agreement in principle includes $20 billion for long-term reform of First Nations Child and Family Services program. Apparently, this will be implemented, according to the government, April 2022. Concrete timeline? And what exactly will be implemented by then? How does $20 billion get allocated? I know it's over 5 years, by April 2022.
Well, April 2022 is when we'll start to see some of those changes take effect. And in fact, these changes, again, will be determined by First Nations leadership, First Nations Child and Family Services, and in partnership with provinces and territories, of course, who hold the pen, if you will, on some of these changes. And you know that we've been working diligently with those provinces and territories to change the face of Child and Family Services across this country through C-92. But listen, This is a work in progress. It will mean equitable funding for services like Jordan's principle. It will mean that communities will have adequate funding. It will mean that communities will be able to fund programs and services like Choose Life, which is a homegrown First Nations developed suicide prevention program that unfolds in different ways across Northern Ontario. That will be expanded to communities that wish to use it across the country. So there's no one answer, Evan, to this work, but there is certainly a number of incredible examples across the country.
Can you tell people how many people is it? There's numbers that we've heard from the AFN that this will impact 200,000 kids and their families. How many people will this impact, the compensation? And how did the government come up with this $40 billion figure? Like, where does that figure come from?
Well, we've used actuarians, we've used a variety of different experts and methodologies, as I think Deputy Grand Chief Narcisse said so eloquently. We've used math and science to determine exactly what compensation should look like and what will be enough to actually cover the compensation needs and the long-term reform needs.
Right.
This government's committed to making sure that people are compensated fairly, obviously, but I think, again, that a long-term reform, that is the real game changer going forward for families.
Okay, just a couple things. Am I right to say this is 200,000 kids?
Well, that number is, you know, listen, there are estimates of kids. It's well over 100,000 individuals. It could be more than that. Right. Again, we don't know the size of the class because, of course, some people, and I will just speak from personal experience, some people will not even know that this deal has been concluded, sadly. I mean, people that I worked with in the community of Thunder Bay, many of them who had been traumatized, multiple, up to 15, 20 first foster homes, oftentimes completely disconnected for their communities. Okay. So there will be work ahead to make sure that everybody who's entitled to compensation knows that they are and gets that compensation.
Okay. So that number can change. Just two last questions real quick. The floor, in other words, the minimum compensation is $40,000. That's what the Human Rights Tribunal talked about. What's the maximum for this government? You've got $20 billion for compensation. Are there figures that we know? Will some people get hundreds of thousands or millions of dollars and some get 40,000? How does that work?
Well, again, that's the process that needs to get worked out now that we have an agreement in principle. The $20 billion is there. We don't have a set ceiling for individuals. First Nations leaders and organizations will help to determine how that compensation unfolds in a fair way. Some people will be, obviously entitled to more depending on their harm and their particular circumstances.
But is it the individual, because remember, in the original case, in the federal court, the judge said that it is not, when they ruled for the Human Rights Tribunal, it was not for individuals to have to fight for individual compensation. So does that mean an individual says, okay, I know 40,000 is the floor, but my experience was X, Y, and Z. I'm now going to get a lawyer and fight for more compensation. Is it now up to individuals, or will there be, this is your possible, areas where you'll get compensated, or do now individuals have to fight for their own compensation?
I think what we want is a system that doesn't make people fight for compensation, that doesn't re-traumatize people in the process of compensation. And that's why it's going to be so important that Indigenous people design the compensation framework. Many of the people that will work on this have lived through previous compensation regimes or witnessed the harm that those compensation regimes have inflicted on individuals. I personally have met and talked to people that, suffered extraordinary harm and abandoned claims through the independent experience process. If you remember, independent experience process that was part of the residential schools process.
Yes.
So we want to make sure that we're avoiding and duplicating those kinds of extremely damaging experiences, and that's why the First Nations leadership is so important in this work.
Just finally, is there a situation that could see the federal government again back in court over the Canadian Human Rights Tribunal ruling or a class action suit, or does the class action suits get dropped now, and does this all do away with the legal challenges now?
Well, I think there is a process whereby once we reach the final agreement, we do need the blessing of the federal court and the Canadian Human Rights Tribunal to make sure that we've met the expectations of those bodies. But yes, this is the actions of a government that does not want to continue litigation. This is the actions of a government that understands we need to move forward in a way that respects Indigenous self-determination over children, respects equity, and pays the bill that is owing to Indigenous families that have been so dramatically harmed.
Okay. There's lots of details to come, but again, $40 billion is a big number over the next 5 years and $20 billion over the next year and a bit. Minister Heidi, thanks for joining us.
Thank you very much, Evan.
Oh, pardon me. Okay, so now we've heard from the government's response. That's the government's response. What's the other side? Let's bring in the person who has led the fight from the start, First Nations Child and Family Caring Society of Canada Executive Director, Cindy Blackstock, has been listening. Cindy, good to see you and Happy New Year to you and your family. Let me just start with your reaction to the announcement. Obviously, we'd heard about this $40 billion number before. Seems to me, and you just heard me question the minister, there's a lot of details missing. What are your big concerns here?
Well, this is a non-binding agreement, and although it provides a pathway forward, it still needs to be landed for children and families. Nothing changed for children and families today. And what we need to see, for example, is on the compensation side. Fortunately, we've already worked on a whole framework about how to roll out that compensation and done so with the involvement of First Nations Youth in Care, who have guided us to say the types of things that need to be there to keep it safe and to make sure that the compensation is maximally available to them. Things like, for example, Evan, many of these victims are still children. Some of them will be 5 years old, some of them will be 8 years old, some of them will be teenagers, and some of them will be young adults. So we need to make sure that the money for the children is in trust, that there's a structured payment system for young and vulnerable people, that there's mental health supports available for young people for whom this might be traumatizing. And most importantly, when those upward adjustments above the 40, that no young person has to be interviewed about their trauma in order to be able to legitimize a higher claim. We have these other independent variables.
So how do you do that? And I just asked Minister Haidu. I said, so if the floor is $40,000, which was determined by the Human Rights Tribunal, but the government's saying, but if someone had a very horrific experience, they may deserve more. How will that be determined? And Minister Haidu just told me, well, First Nations leaders, Indigenous leaders, will decide that. The government is essentially there to provide the pot of money. And how that person finds out what they're going to get above the $40,000 is up to the system. How's that going to work, Cindy Blackstone?
Well, one thing I want to see is, of course, no children interviewed. I think that would be terribly traumatic. We saw it with residential school survivors. Can you imagine asking a child how they were hurt by this discrimination when they're still a child? So what we need to do is take independent markers that we know the government has. So, for example, it knows the number of moves that any First Nations child had who was in care. That could be a factor. Or the age of the child when they went into care, because we know that children who are brought into care at younger ages have worse outcomes. So it's those kinds of things that can be used so that there's evidence base to what the thresholds are for increased compensation.
Right. Okay, so there'll be essentially a formula, X moves or this kind of trauma, so you don't have, so it's not on an individual case-by-case basis. How soon will that system be in place, and how soon can some people actually begin seeing some form of compensation?
Yeah, well, you know, our view is, and regarding the Canadian Human Rights Tribunal funds, that Canada ought to be making these payments as soon as possible. The framework is there, they could provide the monies, and then work out some of the more unanswered questions over the longer run. In terms of setting up these criteria, I know that there's been discussions already about what data is available and how we could actually calibrate it up or down on the basis of those pieces. So I think a lot of that work is done. What we need to do is really avoid these questions about really interviewing children or having to go into their individual files,
right,
because that type of work would take forever.
Right. I mean, but there's still no timeline. The government's saying Indigenous leaders are going to design that system that then will be in place. It seems there's going to be a lot of administration. I tried to ask the government how many people this impacts. We'd heard 200,000 people. The minister said it could be more. There's many people that don't even know they're eligible yet. How many people?
Right. Well, we know for children in care, for example, in the period we're involved in, which is really 2006 forward, Evan, we're talking about 60,000 kids separated from their families because the government of Canada didn't give their families the same kind of access to support. And then on top of that, we have the people for Jordan's Principle. And the way that worked, Evan, is that the government said that even if you're getting less in education or health or social services support, you can't come forward and file a Jordan's Principle request. So many people didn't, but they experienced that discrimination. So for that, there's going to have to be a public outcry and see how many people join in there. But we're talking tens of thousands.
Tens of thousands. Okay.
Tens of thousands.
They're supposed to allocate some of this money in the next coming months, and then there's $20 billion for services. How are they going to allocate the second tranche, the $20 billion, to kind of fix the system? That seems a huge amount of money. I know it's over 5 years, Cindy Blackstock. Do you have any concerns about where that money goes?
Yeah, well, thankfully, we've been doing a lot of work on this, Evan. I really believe in, you know, using the money to maximum effect. So we've been working with the Institute of Fiscal Studies and Democracy with Kevin Page and Helena Gaspard. And that's where that $2,500 per person on prevention comes from, is actually from that evidence on that research. In terms of young people in care, we have the benefit of having seen decades, for decades, young people calling for this. So we're saying that that should be funded on the actual cost. So we get a metric of actually how much it's going to cost to support young people who are leaving care. Before this case, a young person, a First Nations young person at 18 would leave the child welfare system and go out in with no supports whatsoever. Even though if they're non-Indigenous, they would get those supports.
Right.
This is about fixing that. So we're trying to use evidence and use independent costers based on the best First Nations driven research that we can to come up with those monies.
Sydney Black, just two last questions real quick. Does this end this? Does this end the legal child appeals from the government? Does this end the class action suits? Is this the end, or could we see more legal issues?
That depends on the government, really, Evan. It has to land some of these commitments and make the change at the level of children. The tribunal has said the discrimination is felt by the children and young people. So words on paper don't change that. They have to actually do this stuff. And the other thing they need to do is drop their appeals. I mean, they're the ones that have been litigating. So they need to drop their appeal to the Federal Court of Appeal on the compensation. And they also have another appeal that they have before the federal court on buildings to provide those prevention supports. So they need to do that too. So it's really in their hands. I'm hoping that this signals that they're done with litigation, but we'll have to see.
Well, again, significant day, but there's always some key pieces missing, as you say. Cindy Blackstock, thank you today. I always appreciate talking to you. Take care.
Thanks, Evan. Happy New Year to you.
Yeah, Happy New Year to you, too. Coming up, hospitals and schools. Does shutting down in-person learning really help save hospitals from being overrun by Omicron?
We are facing a health and human resource crisis in the healthcare system right now. And we're also seeing, in combination with that, more patients getting sick and coming into hospital.
Why is Ontario delaying the opening of schools by 2 weeks? Why is Manitoba by 1 week? And all lots of other provinces. Should there have been a plan in place to avoid all this? Was Canada ready or not? We'll dig into that next. Stay with us. Welcome back. Hospitals under pressure. Schools delayed in opening. These are big issues for millions and millions of Canadians. Look, three Ontario hospitals have declared code orange, actually. That's an alert level when demand outpaces capacity, so that's a big issue. The rising numbers of COVID-19 patients with Omicron, as well as staffing shortages, are hitting hospitals. Two hospitals in the Greater Toronto Area alone and one in the Ottawa Area are pausing non-urgent procedures to preserve critical care capacity. Let me just give you a snapshot from that province, although every province is going through something like this. According to the latest numbers from Ontario, there are 1,290 residents currently in hospital due to COVID, but only 80% of the eligible Ontarians are fully vaccinated. So how is that playing out? Let me just show you the breakdown of the latest hospitalizations numbers just in Ontario. The vast majority of Ontarians are vaccinated, but some people still obviously develop serious cases. So if you look at non-ICU hospitalizations, about 667 fully vaccinated patients are in non-critical care. 303 unvaccinated patients are in hospital. But the vast majority of Ontario is being vaccinated, Ontarians. So these numbers show just how elevated the overall risk of catching serious COVID is to even unvaccinated people. But look at the ICU admissions. The unvaccinated make up the vast majority of those in critical care, 86. The unvaccinated patients in ICU compared to the 54 fully vaccinated patients. Now, again, those are numbers before Friday. So these new year cases are coming in, a new set of restrictions. Tomorrow, Ontario starts indoor dining and theaters are going to be closed. Gyms will be closed. Students go back online to online learning for a couple weeks in an effort to blunt the Omicron wave. Schools being delayed in many provinces. Just today, Manitoba delayed it again till January 17th. We're about to hear from Alberta in a couple minutes. The press gallery is here to set that all up. Bob Fife is the Globe and Mail's Ottawa Bureau Chief. Emily Nicolas, columnist with Le Devoir. Of course, in Quebec, they've had a curfew there, a very blunt instrument by the government there. And our special guest is Dr. Isaac Bogosh, an infectious disease specialist and epidemiologist. So first of all, Happy New Year to everyone. Can we say Happy New Year as we do a 2020 redux? I don't know if it's happier. We're just still stuck in this kind of COVID hell. But, Doc, let me just start with you. Can we get a reality check? Because I think a lot of folks are wondering, you know, I understand all these governments are worried that the health system is about to be overrun, but is it being overrun by non-vaccinated people or elderly people or people with comorbidities? And for that reason, are we shutting down schools for the right reasons, or should they be open because those folks just don't really get that sick from COVID?
Right. Thanks, Evan. A couple of quick points. One is that if you look at who's in hospital, who's in the ICU, and who succumbs to this illness, it still is overwhelmingly an unvaccinated population. But of course, we know people who are vaccinated can still get sick, and some of them will land in hospital. It's just that the vaccine still confers significant protection against these severe outcomes. Two doses is good. Three doses is better. Schools, I mean, this is obviously a very challenging policy. We know how this disproportionately impacts every working parent, especially moms. I think the key here is twofold. One is, can you buy a little bit more time to ensure that when kids do go back to school, that there's additional safety measures? You've got better masks, more people with access to vaccination, be it a dose one, dose two, dose three. And maybe does this slow things down a little bit in the province or across the country to at least slow this wave even a little bit to help with other vital sectors like healthcare that are really seeing a rise in cases and fewer personnel helping out.
Okay, so that's Ontario. They're trying to protect the system from getting overwhelmed. The price you pay, delaying in-school learning by 2 weeks. I should say that was a big flip-flop for the Ontario government, who said that was only going to be a couple of days, and 4 days later they said, no, it's 2 weeks. Emily, in Quebec, very different. You got a province with a curfew. You got the military being deployed to help the rollout. You got one Quebec hospital CEO saying more than 400 hospital workers have tested positive, so they got a staffing shortage. How is it playing out there in terms of, was your province ready for the surge?
So Quebec seems to be maybe a week, 10 days ahead of Ontario in terms of both implementing measures and also the actual situations, what the numbers are. The government wasn't ready, and so this is why there's so much frustration in terms of the harshness of the measures on the people who, you know, did the right thing, got vaccinated. Of course, everybody wants to protect the hospitals from going over from over capacity, but more and more people are asking, why are the hospitals so fragile, at the first place? And one of the thing that the government doesn't necessarily want to talk about that people have been pointing out to is that actually all across Canada, including in Quebec, healthcare workers have been getting more sick. There's been more COVID-19 transmission in hospitals in Canada than in other countries. And so there's been question raised about why is it that hospital workers don't have access to N95 masks for many months already and things like that. So basically, people do adhere to the measures, but at the same time, they're, you know, asking whether or not there is a political game going on of blaming individuals for spreading the virus while the government is not doing everything that it could from a public policy standpoint, that, you know, on things just like masks, for example, or better ventilation in schools, which is not something that individuals can act on.
Yeah, it's incredible, Bob, as you go through this. There's going to be accountability. I'm not talking about a blame game, but you know, people saw this coming. The science tables in Ontario were warning about this before Christmas to the government. There's going to be a surge, and then there was a 50% capacity, but that obviously didn't work. Now schools are paying the price. People have trouble getting antigen tests, PCR tests. The booster shot rollouts are slow. Like, where's the accountability in your view, Bob?
Well, look, the accountability lies with our government leaders in all the provinces. We were heading into the third year of a pandemic. We've had 2 years of this, and our governments are not prepared. Think about this. We've got kids going to school, to daycares right now. There are no teachers do not have N95 masks. As Emily said, a lot of nurses still do not have N95 masks to be in the hospitals. Rapid tests. We were supposed to have lots of rapid tests. Now you can't get them. The testing centers, they won't take you anymore because they need it only for vulnerable populations. All of this could have, in my view, have been easily planned for. Everybody, all the epidemiologists and healthcare specialists have been warning that there is a possibility of a fifth, a sixth wave that could really cripple the healthcare system. So why aren't we being governments planning for this. It's just appalling when you think about it, that we're all, again, at the same stage where they're rushing out these kind of plans to try to deal with what is increasing problems with hospitalization, when all of this should have been planned out well ahead of time so that, that if this happened, we would be prepared for it.
Yeah, Doc, and I know we're waiting for Alberta, so when Alberta starts and Jason Kenney and Dr. Hinshaw come, I'll jump to that. But, Doc, I was just looking at the Canadian statistics on the percentage of people who have who get COVID, and the people between the ages of basically 0 and 19 make up a grand total of hospitalizations so far of 2.3%. And I guess my question to you, Doctor, is that enough of a justification to keep children out of school and online learning? Or should provinces, like, I get that we got staff shortages and we're protecting the healthcare system, but don't kids got to get in school?
Yeah, I mean, personally, I'm a huge fan of kids going back to school, and I think they should be back in school and we should get them back there as quickly as possible. But also, we shouldn't ignore the safety issues. And of course, while it is true that kids just don't get as sick as adults, some kids do. It's just less common. We also have to think about kids not living in a vacuum, right? These kids are all going home to families. Some families will have vulnerable people living there, and those families are also integrated in the communities around them. So we certainly know if appropriate measures aren't taken in the schools, schools can certainly amplify this virus, and they have in the past. And this has happened to different degrees in various provinces, depending on what safeguards are placed in schools. Even in a perfect setting with unlimited resources, you're still going to see outbreaks in schools. But yeah, I mean, I think we just have to get those schools as safe as we possibly can, as quickly as we possibly can. And I mean, different provinces are at different rates, at paces of doing this. But yeah, I'd love to see kids back in school as soon as possible, obviously not just for education, but for social development. And then we have to think about the giant inequity that school closures is, right? Yeah. Every working parent and every mom is disproportionately impacted by this.
Okay, I'm going to have to leave it there tonight. Thank you to Dr. Bogosh, and Emily and Bob, thank you. That is your Power Play Day in Politics today. Again, Happy New Year. Here we go again. Another wave of COVID. We'll be watching all the news for that. Thanks for watching. And we still have to say it. Hug your loved ones even in 2022 if it's safe to do so. We'll see you back here tomorrow night.